It has just been pointed out to me that there is yet one more mistake in the schedule of classes. I don't know what this is. I must have really been in bad shape. Apparently, I had February 26th, chapters 17, sections 1 and 2. And is it 17? Is that it's 17, right?
Yep.
And then March 4th, chapter 17, sections 1 and 2. It should be March 4th, chapter 17, section 3. That's not a big, that's not as bad as skipping a day because Robin's
giving
the day off.
He's trying.
All right. We didn't get too far into chapter 8 last week, so the first thing that we're going to do this week is to cover that in detail, and then we'll do as much as we can with chapter 9 or chapters 9 and 10. I doubt that we'll get to 10 at all today. But since we've got a little freedom with the December 4th class, so I'm not worried. So chapter 8 then, there were three handouts, the notes for chapters 9 and 10, and then two articles, one by Paul Kidder, one is a thing for Lonergan from the journal Method, Journal of Lonergan Studies, and another article, a piece by Joseph Flanagan of Boston College, that's disappeared in the book Creativity and Method, From Body to Thing. And they'll both be helpful, and we'll actually be referring to Kidder's article in some detail today. So there's another type of insight then, the insight into a unity, an identity, a whole in data, in their concrete individuality and in the totality of their aspects. And that insight grasps what this chapter is referred to as a thing. Now Kidder suggests on page 11 of his article that because he used the word thing so generically, and we talk about, you know, if you see a sunset and you say, isn't that an amazing thing? Well, of course, thing there is not thing in Lonergan's sense. Or wasn't that an awful thing? You don't mean, usually, that it was an awful unity identity whole. It was an awful event, you know. So he suggests that it might have been better. There's a problem with this suggestion, but it might have been better if Lonergan had used a term like a being, or a being in the strict sense. Now, the problem with that is that he hasn't yet introduced the notion of being, and so we don't know yet what being is for him. And so for him to say a being at this point would be premature, because we don't know what that is. Being is a further notion that doesn't come up until chapter 12. But at any rate, there is a problem with the use of the word thing, because we use it so loosely and so generically to refer to almost anything. You know? So that, but a thing, in the sense in which he's using it here, is an explanatory notion, and it's a unity to which there belongs every aspect of every datum within the unity. Now, I'm going to ask you right now, if you would. Oh, by the way, before I forget, I mentioned this once before, but on the MP3s, the MP3 for August 7th from track 2244 to the end is Lonergan's covering of the notion of thing. So, and then I'll mention at the beginning when we move to chapter 9 where you'll get the MP3 material for that. But that's where you'll get it on there. So if we turn to Kidder's article, What is the Thing for Lonergan? And start with page 3 at the bottom, if you would, because I think it helps fill out the first section of the chapter. Okay, so you got that? So the notions of unity, identity, and wholeness, Sheldon, we're taking the Kidder article here, I'm taking a couple of paragraphs starting at the bottom of page 3. The notions of unity, identity, and wholeness that go into Lonergan's description of the thing insight can be misinterpreted. Of these three terms, unity, identity, whole, greatest stress must fall upon the third, whole, the thing as a whole, the thing as a totality of aspects. This totality is not complete in any one place or at any one moment of time. It is whole only when considered in light of every place it occupies or can occupy and over the whole temporal range of its existence. he'll give the example in a couple of paragraphs of a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. Well, a butterfly, all right? It's one thing. It's one unity identity whole over this, the totality of its aspects throughout its history. So it's the that sense of the totality is not complete in any one place or at any one moment of time. That's true of us, the totality of me, you know, and it's different today from what it was yesterday. But that instance of a caterpillar becoming a butterfly is an even more clear instance of that. But the totality is only complete when its existence is finished, if you want. But otherwise, it's in development. So this totality is not complete in any one place or any one moment of time. It is whole only when considered in light of every place it occupies or cannot occupy and over the whole temporal range of its existence. One must emphasize this sense of totality in order to avoid reading too much of Aristotle into Lockerbie. And there's certainly a continuity here. But what Kidder says is, he says there's a temptation, I suspect, to focus on the term identity, to think of the insight into the thing as a grasp of the substrate that persists through change that underlies accidental properties. Now, I don't know that that reading is as untrue to Lonergan as he's saying here, but there is more to, I would want to put it this way, that there's more to what Lonergan is saying than that a thing is a substance to which accidental properties adhere. The thing is a concrete totality that includes what Aristotle called accidents, so long as these are grasped not abstractly in their relativity, but concretely in their individuality. Okay. Again, the next paragraph I think is helpful too. To say that the notion of the thing regards data as individual and concrete is not to say that it regards data as immediate. On the contrary, the very concreteness of a thing is realized only in a totality that transcends any particular immediate experience. The totality stretches across past, present, and future, and always includes parts that are unavailable to immediate perception. Again, think of the caterpillar and the butterfly. The very concreteness of a thing, then, can be grasped only through inquiry and understanding. Through sensation, you don't grasp the identity, the unity identity whole of the caterpillar that's become a butterfly. You don't get that through sensation. You only get it through inquiry and understanding. Such inquiry, moreover, will be impossible without the help of abstractive insights that grasp relations. One cannot grasp a water molecule, for example, as a single thing until one understands enough about laws of heating and cooling to know that liquid water, ice, and steam are different states in which the one thing can exist. An explicit formulation of this complementarity between concrete and abstractive insights yields a linked pair of concepts, thing and property. The very same data which taken concretely yield insight into a thing may, when considered from various abstractive viewpoints, yield insights into what may be called properties of that thing. The complementarity between these two types of insights implies a dialectical course for all learning about things. That is, better knowledge of any given thing is achieved through better understanding of properties, and superior knowledge of properties requires an ever-improving grasp of the whole, the wholes to which they belong. One might ask, could one learn all of the properties of a given thing and then in one overarching insight grasp them at once in all of their concreteness? Certainly any attempt to understand the thing properly heads towards such an ideal and approaches it asymptotically, the notion of the asymptote in mathematics, that you're always moving toward, but you never quite get there. But it is surely more doubtful whether such a comprehensive overarching insight into a thing ever occurs. And that, you know, we never know completely anything. We don't know ourselves completely. We don't know each other completely. We don't know anything completely. The overwhelming richness of data and intelligibility within our experience of things is the very reason why abstraction is necessary in any attempt to understand them. Skip a paragraph and we'll get to the example here. The differences between Lonergan's and Aristotle's views is made vivid in a case such as that of a caterpillar that becomes a butterfly. To explain such seemingly total transformations, the Aristotelian is forced to hunt for some bit of material substrate that never changes throughout the whole transformation. But the likelihood is that in that transformation, everything changes, and yet it's the same whole. It's the same thing. A person taking Lonergan's view is satisfied to note that the enormous changes in the creature do not occur all at once, but in succession, so that each is partial, and each is part of a single instance of development through stages. To this, one might object that while each individual change in the development might be partial, the Lonerganian would admit as a thing something which at the end of the process was utterly different in every respect from what it was at the beginning. And such a thing is really two things, but it isn't. The reply would be that the objection conceives a beginning and an end abstractly, whereas in reality things are concrete and only get from beginning to end by traversing all of the necessary stages. Okay, so that I wanted to bring that up, and then I want also to look at one other point that he raises in the article is, what do you do about artifacts? Are artifacts things? Is a painting a thing? Is this book a thing? Is your computer a thing? Well, you might think of it as, you know, awful thing sometimes, but is it a unity identity whole? I think that some different notion is required when we come to artifacts. When we come to the question that he asks, is my sweater a thing? Well, I think we've got to have some kind of further notion beyond body and thing to talk about the creations of human beings, and particularly the artistic creations of human beings. I think we need some kind of hermeneutical notion that we have not gotten to yet, and that perhaps there will be material later on in the book when Lonergan turns to his hermeneutic theory in chapter 17 that would help us to answer that question. I think that what Lonergan means by things are the kinds of things that Kidder points out on page 11 here in his article, where he makes the suggestion that being might have been an easier word or a more intelligible word for Lonergan to use besides think. If you look around the middle of page 11, Lonergan himself says in Latin the same thing that Kidder is saying in English when he writes in De Constitutione Christi, in that little Latin that's it. More strictly, a being is that which is. Thus, God, angels, human beings, animals, plants, minerals, because they are more strictly called beings. And Kidder is suggesting that that's the sense in which the word thing should be used. The list of objects here is limited to those that Lonergan would call things, though God and angels are not treated in chapter 8, and he's treating material things, really, because he talks about them as being extended in space changing in time and so on. He chooses to name them with the word entia in Latin rather than res, entia meaning beings rather than things. But I think he's right. I think that's what Lonergan, those are the examples of the kinds of things that he means by things. And when you're turning to artifacts, we have to have another category. It is definitely true that if that painting in the back of the room is something to which everything about it belongs, but it belongs because of the creative input of the artist who painted it. And I think we need another notion besides thing or body to talk about what we're talking about. So we need a hermeneutical notion, we need an artistic notion of what is a work of art. And I don't think that this language is enough to determine that. Okay? So that basically takes us only down, in terms of the notes for chapter 8, only down to number 4 on page 2, and that's about as far as we got last week. So if you could turn to the notes that I gave you in chapter 8. Does anybody need a set of notes for chapter 8? And it would be number 4 on page 2, which would be where we are at the moment. And the point of number 4, and the point, this is a point that's emphasized throughout the chapter, it begins to get emphasized in part 1 in the chapter, is that only the explanatory perspective gives you things themselves. Okay? The descriptive can't quite get there yet. All right? So you've got to move to the level of explanation. While all existing things are particular, we can abstract from their particularity and speak both of things in general and of things of determinate kind specified by their conjugates or properties. The conjugates may be experiential or explanatory, but I think the point of what he's saying here and saying throughout the chapter is that it's only the differentiating things by their explanatory conjugates that gives you the things themselves. There are data on things only in as much as they're related to our senses. So there are data on any things only insofar as we can see them or hear them or touch them or whatever. It follows that we can't appeal to data as long as we're considering things themselves, things as explained, things as related to one another, things as equivalent for all observers in as much as one prescinds from all observers in as much as one prescinds from observation, from seeing, from hearing, from touching, from tasting, and so on. When there is no possibility of observation, there is no possibility there of a verifiable image. For the imagined as imagined can be verified, can be verified. You can have an image, but you can verify that image only when what is imagined can also be sensed. Accordingly, there are, you start with what is probably the simplest example of a thing. There are no verifiable images for subatomic elements. None of us has ever seen an electron. There are no verifiable images because you can't see them. But if subatomic elements cannot be imagined, then atoms cannot be imagined. For one cannot imagine a whole as made up of non-imaginable parts. And so on. It follows that no thing itself, no thing as explained, can be imagined. This sounds crazy because when we get up to trees and animals and human beings, well, we can imagine them because we can see them, but not as explained. Okay? And that's the point. And it's the thing as explained that is the thing itself. If atoms can't be imagined by parity of reasoning, molecules can't be imagined. If molecules can't be imagined, neither can cells. If cells can't be imagined, then neither can plants. Once one enters upon the way of explanation by relating things to one another, one has stepped out of the path that yields valid representative images. And if you don't have valid representative images, then you can't imagine. You cannot imagine even a tree as explained. You can imagine a tree and as described. And you can have knowledge of that tree. You can have descriptive knowledge of it. And you can affirm it as real. But to know it itself in its thinghood is to know it through the conjugates that are known by the laws of the sciences. Okay? And the images, any images that you use there would be heuristic images, images that would lead you to insight, but not images that would actually represent or tell you what a scientific tree looks like. A tree is a tree, and a tree looks like a tree, but a tree as scientifically known is not imagined. Is that okay? Again, Kidder, let me just refer you to Kidder. He's got something on this on page 8 in his article. A thing is known through its properties, which is to say, through its relations with other things. A thing is known incompletely if only some of these relations are known. But relations divide into two types: descriptive relations, whereby things are related to our senses, and explanatory relations, whereby things are related to one another. Lonergan suggests that the notion of things straddles descriptive and explanatory context, and that's true, it does. But he would go on to say that it's the explanation. Much of science begins with a process of categorization based on description, by developing systematic ways of classifying things according to observable similarities and differences among them. But such descriptive categorizations are incomplete. They're a kind of preparation for asking the explanatory questions and proposing explanatory theories that reveal why the things described are less categorizable. We begin with a set of things described and end with a set of things explained. Excuse me. This set is the same set, and throughout the process, the notion of things serves to identify the concrete unity to which both descriptive and explanatory attributes pertain. contained. There is, however, a difficulty here. The itinerary I have described from description to explanation is straightforward enough when dealing with things such as the plants and animals of Linnaeus's tables, but it encounters complications in the case of objects such as rocks, puddles, or clouds. One can categorize rocks by size, weight, shape, coloring, locality, and so forth, so in terms of their relations to us. But once the descriptive process moves towards explanation, the rocks that one had believed to be things reveal themselves to be merely coincidental aggregates of chemical things. A rock is not a thing on this page, on this notion of thing. A rock is an aggregate of a number of chemical things. Thus, explanation has the power to break down our common sense world and to carry us into a whole new world of things themselves. Moreover, it would seem to follow that it is this new explanatory world of things that contains the true things. Descriptions are verifiable only as relations to us, not as properties independent of our perceptions. As properties independent of our perceptions, only explanations are verifiable. But if this is so, one begins to wonder how many of the things we think we know are really and truly things. Recent centuries have brought so many breakthroughs in the understanding of explanatory relations that even common sense now questions the ultimate veracity of its own assessments of color, weight, hardness, and other descriptive qualities. And so on. I think we need to read the rest of that picture. It's just that we're moving into another world here. It's like Edison's two tables. Or is it Edison or Eddington? Eddington's two tables. There's this table that we see that is brown and hard and that you can lay things on and sit on, and then there's the table that's explained, which is unimaginable. It's not an unimaginable. And as explained, it is not a thing. It's an aggregate of a number of chemical things. Yes.
Would there be, therefore, a difference between, let's say, looking at the sun and, let's say, an asteroid? Asteroid being just like a rock.
Well,
an aggregate of.
Isn't the sun also an aggregate?
In part, but so is a tree.
Well, is it? See, that's the question.
Yeah.
That's the question. Is there a difference between the sun and a tree from this standpoint of a unity identity? That's the question. The moon is not a thing. The moon is an aggregate of a lot of things.
Just like the earth is.
Yeah. It's not a thing on the sun. But a tree is, a dog is, you are.
Having come to an end, would the Roman Empire, for example, be a thing now that it's complete?
No.
No? Okay.
It wouldn't. It's a historical period. It's a category of... There's a whole set of very interesting historical questions of, like, when has something come to an end?
The incarnation,
Jesus,
being the whole length of Jesus' earthly life, having come to an earthly end, would that be a thing?
Well, he is.
Yeah.
On this term, he is, because he's a unity identity whole, and different from any one of us, if you accept the dogma. But still, it's one person. And if it's one person, then it's a thing. Persons. Over the course of his existence and continuum in his risen life, because that's not one person.
Is the key identity, the unity identity whole, so something has to have an actual identity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The interesting question that you asked, for instance, about the Roman Empire, or even about historical questions, this is a whole other question, so I don't want to get way off base on this, but it's just that when you say, well, it has come to an end. Well, for historians, has it come to an end? Because the whole history of the Roman Empire will be continually rewritten until the end of time, as new data are uncovered, as new perspectives and new questions are raised, and so on. There is a sense in which, I mean, Lonergan says it's likely that Nero will always be Nero. Like, there's not going to be a lot more done on Nero. But we can't say the same thing about Luther or Schleier. Because they're too important, and they've influenced this whole other realm of being, which is human history, filled with meanings that these categories are just not big enough to cover. You've got to have categories of hermeneutics and history to speak about what's going on there, because you're into the world of human meanings at that point. And from that standpoint, the important contributors to human meaning, their reality, their meaningful contribution is probably never at an end. We will always be reading Luther and Schleiermacher probably till the end of time. That we'll probably be reading them and finding something new or longer. You know, the book will not probably never be closed. Those contributors to the values and values. Nero, maybe. But that's a whole other reality. What constitutes a historical unity? See, that's different. What constitutes an artistic unity? I don't think these categories are broad enough to cover those.
Mom?
Yes.
How does a tree embrace a totality of aspects that a rock doesn't? Or how do I do that?
Well, it would be from the standpoint of things as explained scientifically. I mean, a scientist will tell you that a rock is really an aggregate of a number of chemical elements. From a descriptive standpoint, a rock seems to be every much a thing as a tree. But the scientific explanation of that will say, no, there's a big difference. The same thing with the moon, you know. The moon is not one thing. But it's from the standpoint of the things as explained, not from the thing as from the thing as described.
What is it in the tree is explained or me is explained that is that linchpin that says this isn't just an aggregate, this is a whole?
Yeah, it's the way in which the conjugates are related to one another to contribute to the I can't give you the scientific thing because I don't know enough about either the laws that constitute a rock, the chemical elements that constitute a rock, and the laws that constitute a tree. I'm taking it in some sense on faith that science will tell you that a rock is an aggregate, where science will tell you that the tree is not. How else can I come at that question?
Because I'm just thinking a tree is part of an ecosystem, and you know, it's you know.
Oh, sure.
Related.
Sure. I mean, we're part of an ecosystem.
Yeah.
Ecosystem. Each one of us is. But that doesn't. The ecosystem is. There are elements from the ecosystem that are incorporated into us as we breathe, and as we breathe out, that are put back into the ecosystem, and as we eat and drink and so on and so forth. But there's the wholeness of the thinking over the period of time. It's easier to grasp, I think, with living things. That's why I've asked, like I said, plants, animals, and human beings, like, for instance. You can take if a rock is not too permeable, you can take it and you can crush it. I mean, if it's not too hard, you know, I mean, you can pick up a piece of dirt you could form it into something if you packed it. You could form it into something that you could throw and hit somebody in the head with it, but you could also take it and just crush it to pieces. But I think, you know, it's the whole business of thinking of these things from the standpoint of explanation. I think the question that you're raising is indicative of our need to move, if we're going to grasp what he's talking about, to move to the standpoint of explanation. Why isn't this a tree? I mean, why isn't this a thing? Okay, this could be every much This on the standards that you're appealing to could be every much counted as a thing, as a every bit as much as a rock could be.
Oh, I'm not wanting to appeal to any standards.
No.
I'm just wondering what in explanatory conjugates,
yeah,
see, allows
well,
us
I
to
I can't
say
tell
this
you
is a
what the explanatory conjugates are because I don't know the science.
But you're saying that the Earth is an aggregate?
And the Gaia hypothesis, for instance, that would treat the Earth as a thing. And I think there's a lot to the Gaia hypothesis in terms of like ecology and so on that we have to pay attention to. But to think of it as a thing is not. It's not wrong. It means many, 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 many things. Many.
I think I can understand why a tree would be a thing,
yeah,
and a table wouldn't.
That's right.
But why wouldn't a computer be a thing?
Well, okay, I think it's the question of artifacts, and this is one of the issues that Kidder raises in his article. And his suggestion is that any human creation, like a computer, an automobile, or a work of art, that we need further categories to talk about the reality that we're dealing with there, because they're products of human meaning. When we get to the end of the chapter, we will see that the human thing is the source of a whole new series of realities invested with meaning. And he's simply at the end of the chapter leaving open the issue that he'll only take up in chapter 17, that we need more categories for understanding what it is that human beings create. That the thing body language is not enough.
Then are we saying it's only an organism that is a biological organism, not created by human,
well,
can be a thing?
No, because at least on the basis of the way he's speaking in the examples that he gives in De Constitutione Christi, he talks about minerals as instances of things, and they're not living organisms. But. I don't think that any. Now, as Kidder says in the book here, that these were raging questions of Boston College when he was a student there, and Lonergan was still there. And so Kidder took a whole list of things to Lonergan. And he said, I just want you to say yes or no. And Lonergan said yes or no to everything, but he said, please don't record my answers. He was at that point where he was tired of being quoted, I think, at least that's what Kidder says. So he didn't. But you can see from Kidder's own, that thing that I just read you from the De Constitutione Christi on page 11, that it would seem that Lonergan would talk about such things as the things that he calls entia in the strict sense, beings in the strict sense. God, angels, human beings, animals, plants, minerals, because they are called beings in a stricter sense. It would seem that that's what Lonergan means by things.
Okay. When he says that a mineral is a thing, is it because in its own chemical construction, the different elements, it is the different atoms and molecules, are forming a purposeful structure?
Yes.
So is the whole notion of purpose here that different things are related to each other purposefully to create a whole?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has to come into that, I think. I think that notion has to come into that. Okay.
That's the most clear.
But again, it's a heuristic notion, and so we don't, I mean, I'd like to have been around when they were asking, you know, is this jacket a thing? Well, he's at the end of the chapter. Kidder's suggesting that human creations need further categories. This is not enough to talk about. But in fact, what we're doing when we create anything, when we make a sweater, or you make a computer or something like that, is that you're taking a lot of things in this strict sense and putting them together into something that because you are intelligent, you are able to do it, and you're participating in the creativity, I mean, from a theological standpoint, of the creator of the universe. You know, you're taking those things and making new aggregates of human creativity. But the fact is that we need more
sophisticated scientific categories to cover that, hermeneutical categories to cover art, and so on, before we really have an adequate set of categories to talk about these things. Let's move to bodies, number five here. Contrasted with the notion of thing in this precise sense of it is the notion of body as an already out there now real, already out there now real. Bodies, one target that, expression that Kidder has in his article is that bodies are targets of animal knowing. Or they're targets of our sense knowing. They're the targets of our animal knowing. And I was thinking when I read that, that I walk past a pet shop every day on my way to and from work, and there's a cat in the window. And I have quite a relationship with this cat. And I usually have my cane. And I hold out the cane, and if the cat is awake, he or she pays very strict attention to that cane and watches it go up and down. Down on the ground and shaking the bushes and everything. I mean, quite interesting. Okay, now the cane is a target of that animal's knowing, right? And it's a body in this sense. And body is an epistemological category, right? Because I'm also a body for that cat. Right, the cat is not saying this is a unity identity whole. That as a target of the cat's knowing, I'm what Lonergan's referring to as a body here. The body's an epistemological category. So what is a thing in the strict sense can also cognitively be a body because it's the target of sense knowing and sense knowing only. Okay? So a body. So an already out there now real. Already. It's already there. So I come up on the cat, you know, and he doesn't see me coming, and then all of a sudden I'm there with the cane. The orientation and dynamic anticipation of biological consciousness. Such consciousness does not create, but finds its environment. It finds it as already constituted, already offering opportunities, already issuing challenges. Out, it's spatial. Extroversion, the extroversion of a consciousness that is aware not of its own ground, but of objects distinct from itself. There and now indicate the spatial and temporal determinations of extroverted consciousness. Real finally is a subdivision within the field of the already out there now. Because what you see, I mean, you could see something that's a hallucination, okay? So we know that what's already out there now is partly hallucinatory and partly real. And how do you know if it's really real when you go on and touch it and so on and so forth? And otherwise it might just be a hallucination. There was a dog once I was visiting the Jesuit infirmary at Pickering, and I'd been bringing this bag, you know, like a gym bag. And I put it on the ground, and the dog there, when he was going around from a distance, growled at it because he thought it might be alive. But as he got closer to it, went up to it, very carefully sniffing, and all of a sudden he realized it's just a bag. Well, it's no longer important, you see. Well, but there's what's already out there now can be interpreted in different ways at a sense level. I guess the example of hallucination would be a clearer example. So the real is a subdivision within the field of the already out there. Now part of that's mere appearance, but part is real. And its reality consists in its relevance to biological success or failure, pleasure or pain. So Lonergan says on 279, by a body, and again this is epistemological language here, is meant primarily a focal point of extroverted biological anticipation and attention. It's an already out there now real, where these terms have their meaning fixed solely by elements within sensitive experience, and so without any use of intelligent and reasonable questions and answers. Knowledge of bodies is not intelligent or conceptual. It's simply sense. It's not a grasp by insight of an intelligible unity grasped in data as individual. But it can subtly invade scientific and philosophic thinking. There can be a mixture, and so you can start to think in categories that ultimately can be quite confusing philosophically. When Galileo pronounced secondary qualities like color and sound to be merely subjective, what's really real is what you would know in terms of light waves or sound waves, but the color and the sound are not really real. What he meant was they're not already out there now real in this biological sense. When the decadent Aristotelians in the 14th century, and generally people that rely on good common sense, insist that secondary qualities obviously are objective, what they mean is, well, they're already out there now real. That green is already out there now real, but that's objective. When Descartes maintained that material substance must be identical with spatial extension, his material substance was the already out there now real. When Kant argued that primary and secondary qualities are merely phenomena, he meant that for him, the reality of the already out there now real was mere appearance. Our own position, as contained in the canon of parsimony, and this will be developed at great length in the second part of the book, is the real is the verified. If you can verify, it's real. Because then you have verification grounds assent. And the real is what is known in assent, in judgment. So the real is the verified. It is what is to be known by the knowing constituted by experience and inquiry, insight and hypothesis, reflection and verification. My present point is that besides knowing in that rather complex sense, there is also knowing in the elementary sense in which kittens know the reality of milk. Okay. Now we have that kind of knowing too, and it at times, I mean, in moments of danger, the biological pattern of experience is something that, as animals, we need. And in moments of danger, it can be extremely helpful. There's stimulus response, knowing. Okay, now a lot of cognitive psychology in the behaviorist sense treats all human knowing as simply stimulus and response, without talking about the processing of things through interiority and through the operations of interiority, through understanding and judgment. But stimulus response is a form of knowing. The point is, there are two kinds of knowing that go on in us. And what Lonergan's trying to do is to get us to distinguish them. Okay, that's the point. The point is not to exclude the one completely. We do have animal knowing. And at times it goes into effect, but if we the problem is if you confuse the criteria of full human knowing and turn those into the criteria of the animal knowing within us, so that the real becomes the already out there now, and objectivity is a matter of seeing everything that's there and not seeing anything that isn't there, and knowing is a matter of just taking a really good look. Well, that's not full human knowing. That's biological knowing, yes, but it's not full human knowing. So the differences between the two types of knowing, that's the point he's trying to make here, are the following. The elementary type is constituted completely on the level of experience. Neither questions for intelligence nor questions for reflection have any part in its genesis. And as questions do not give rise to it, neither can they undo it. Essentially, it's unquestionable. On the other hand, in fully human knowing, experience, so seeing, touching, tasting, hearing, smelling, supplies no more than materials for questions. Questions are essential to its genesis. Through questions for intelligence, it moves to accumulations of related insights, which are expressed or formulated in concepts, suppositions, definitions, postulates, hypotheses, theories. And through questions for reflection, it attains a further component which we will see probably today when we get into chapter 9. And then number 8, each type is valid. So it's not a point of saying that the elementary type of knowing is not valid. Each type is valid. And the problem is not one of elimination of one or the other, but of critical distinction. The difficulty lies not in either type of knowing by itself, but in the confusion that arises when one shifts unconsciously from one type to the other, and especially in the confusion that can arise in a philosophy if the criteria for the world of immediacy are made into the criteria of what is real. That's where the problem arises. Another way, the other way, Lonergan's later way of putting the same distinction epistemologically is to distinguish between the world and the immediacy. And the world mediated by meaning. The world of immediacy for human beings is the world of the infinite. Before the infant has learned language. Language, infant, literally means non-speaking. And the world of immediacy is the world of the nursery. It's the world of what can be immediately seen, heard, touched, tasted, and so on. Once language becomes something once language becomes a medium, the world expands. And the world mediated by meaning, the criteria for the world mediated by meaning are the criteria of experience, understanding, and judgment. The criteria for the world of immediacy is a matter of, take a real good look. Okay. But that's not, the problem philosophically is if a philosopher takes those criteria over into and tries to tell you from on the basis of those criteria what reality is, what is real. Then you get into empiricism, for instance, that only if you can see it and touch it and taste it is it real. And naive realism and so on. Naive realism is a philosophy that lives in a world mediated by meaning that uses the criteria of the world of immediacy to talk about it. So how do you know what's real? Take a good look and you'll see being. Okay. Well, you don't see being. No being by assenting. We'll see more of this as we go on. We use the word see so much. We will encounter more of this as we go on. You don't see being. You assent to being. You know being by assent. You don't know being by looking. You know color by looking. So each type is valid. The difficulty lies not in knowing either type of knowing by itself, but in the confusion that arises when one shifts unconsciously from one type to the other. Animals have no epistemological problems. That is to say, you can confuse an animal. You can play games with them. That's not what he means. But he means that they don't have any problem with what's the criteria of what's real. They don't ask that question. Neither do scientists, as long as they stick to their task of observing, forming hypotheses, and verifying. The perennial source of nonsense is that after the scientist has verified his hypothesis, he's likely to go a little further and tell us what approximately scientific reality looks like. Okay? And then there's even that they've got to come up with a picture. Well, you don't have a picture that corresponds to the formulae of explanation. There is no picture. Again, we're dealing with a dialectic, but in a different sense of the term. There are two types of knowing. Each is modified by its own development. They are opposed, for one arises through intelligent and reasonable questions and answers, knowing in the world mediated by meaning, and the other does not. They're linked together in the human person, who is at once an animal, intelligent, and reasonable. Unless they're distinguished sharply by a critical theory of knowledge, they become confused. Generate aberrations that afflict not only scientific thought, but far more conspicuously the thought of philosophy. Lonergan will say at one point that all the way from Scotus to Hegel, philosophers were laboring under the implicit assumption that knowing is like taking a good look. And the fact of the matter is that understanding and judging are not like looking. They're very different activities. They can't be Try to understand them on the basis of an ocular analogy is thrown off base. Any questions, and then we can break because we're at the John.
Given this distinction of body and thing, could you just reiterate that example of Augustine's so-called intellectual conversion?
Yeah, Augustine said that it took him years to discover that the meaning of the word real was not the same as the meaning of the word body. And by that he meant that he was laboring under the implicit assumption that for a thing to be real, for a thing to be acknowledged as real, it somehow had to satisfy the criteria of the world of the meanings.
It had to be a body.
It had to be, you had to be able to see it, you had to be able to hear it, you had to be able to touch it, there had to be some way in which you could do that. And then for Augustine, the shift was precisely Lonergan's shift. That the real is the truth. For him, it was the truth. For Lonergan, the verified. It's the same thing. The verification is what grounds the ascent to truth. But it was when Augustine came to see that the real is the true. And the true is not out, the true is not up, the true is not down, the true is. It's not up, down, out, in. Spatial categories don't. It just is. And space is within being, not the other way around. And within, even within, is a spatial term. Or Heidegger. The issue with Heidegger, I mean, one way of putting it, it's much more subtle than this, but is being within time or is time within being? I think you can grant just about everything that Heidegger says, but still there is time.
Well, I guess when you talk about hallucinations, you mean things like mirages or optical illusions.
They're already out there, but if you look a little harder, you realize they're not real.
Mm. It's not hallucinations from
taking
magic mushrooms.
Because it doesn't have being.
Well, ultimately, it's not verified. As long as you're going on this, you just say, well, okay, I just took a better look.
This gets away from the course material a bit, but I'm realizing that the postmodern project is largely a response or a critique of the possibility of an explanatory account. Isn't this what they're critical of when they say that detached objectivity is impossible? Are they saying an explanatory account is impossible?
I don't know. Sure. Because, if they were saying that, then would they be saying Einstein was really creating stories? I don't think you can say that.
It's funny, I'm just noticing a lot of other patterns, such as somebody like Lacan desiring a return to the world of immediacy. Post-structuralists in general seem to be at least really weary of a world mediated by meeting in a Lonerganian sense and of an explanatory account.
Yeah, that's probably right. Postmodern, one of the things, postmodern means a lot of different things. It's a question of who you mean. There's a postmodern option. We can speak about a postmodern option. We're dissatisfied with modernity in many ways. And you can go with. There are many different routes that we can take, one of which is the post-structuralist route, their opposition would be, the post-structuralist at least would be. They will be reacting against the kind of explanatory perspective that you have in Levi Strauss, for instance, which is problematic. I think it is problematic.
Sorry, I was just thinking of a particular article where some feminist scholar said that the account of, a sperm and entering an egg was misogynist insofar as they were so sure that it was the sperm that was active that it took the feminists to come along and say, well, are we sure that the egg is totally docile, for them to find out that actually it's the egg that has, cilia, sort of, that pulls it in. And so, part of the...
But see, that in itself is a further explanatory. proposition. It's not contra explanation.
Oh, that's right.
It's scientific. That's adding to scientific.